So I would just find ways of getting into the fight. If there was an open back door to the arena, or if there was a crack wide enough for me to squeeze through, I would work my way into the fight. Oscar's kind of doubled up. And I'm thinking to myself, was that punch low or was it a good punch? And so I'm counting. I've already started counting. Well, I got to keep counting now. So I count Oscar out. After that call, and after we took Meldrick Taylor back to his dressing room, as soon as he walked into his dressing room, he threw up blood. The blood that he threw up was because he had lacerations on the inside of his lip. And during the course of the fight, he was swallowing it. He had two orbital fractures over both eyes. And they said he was totally dehydrated.
Hello, and welcome to Boxing Life Stories with me, Tris Dixon.
What happened in the ring after Tyson Oliver was child's play compared to that one?
I still get goosebumps to this day.
you couldn't take the tears from his eyes or the smile off his face, could you?
I know.
He's beating me. He said, well, let's pull you back.
And the paper, they made me look like Al Capone.
This is going to be your night.
His winning and his nothing else.
Hello, welcome back to Boxing Life Stories. This week, I'm joined by Las Vegas referee Kenny Bayless, and he's been in boxing for more than four decades and he's been the third man in the ring for some of the biggest fights in history, including the biggest money fight of all time, Floyd Mayweather against Manny Pacquiao. Kenny and I met up at the International Boxing Hall of Fame recently, and we talked about doing this, and Kenny was in demand and doing ringside lectures and here, there, and everywhere. And after we finally did this Zoom, I was very, very grateful that we'd held off doing it in person, because this was a great deep dive. Some of Kenny's stories about being on the commission in the 80s, even before he became a referee, are absolutely brilliant. Just great stuff here with Kenny. Also, a reminder, guys, that Ringside Rewind is now live. That's a podcast I'm recording weekly with Ian Dark and John Rawling, talking about their careers and the massive fights they've covered and the big names they've worked with. And it's been terrific fun to do. We have had a real laugh doing it. So check out Ringside Rewind. The first six episodes are all up on my Patreon, patreon.com/TrisDixon. And huge thanks to my sponsors at Hanson Lee Resourcing. They were voted the UK's best specialist insurance sector recruitment firm at the Corporate Excellence Awards. Not only do Hanson Lee find you the best people, but they help you retain them. And you can find out more at hansonlee.com. We're also brought to you by Delco Safety Compliance, and they are a leading provider of professional fire risk assessments and safety services nationwide. They provide expert and partial advice on all aspects of fire, health and safety compliance. And you can find out more at delcosafety.co.uk. And now here's Kenny Bayless.
Kenny, it's great to see you. Obviously, I saw you briefly at the International Boxing Hall of Fame, but you're a regular there. What makes you keep going back to Canastota?
My first time there was in 2009. Me and my wife went. And I fell in love with the place. It's just a wonderful experience to be around boxing fans. The way you do, it's very personal. It's up close. And Ed Brophy, the director of the Hall of Fame, does a fantastic job with the volunteers. And it's just a great time.
And you don't go alone either. You take a whole mob of you guys now from Vegas.
Well, I've been trying to get more of the officials to come. Believe it or not, a lot of our Nevada officials, as well as officials from California, Arizona, all around the country, don't know about the International Boxing Hall of Fame. Even officials that live on the East Coast, which makes them even closer to attend, and so I share and I try to open up the gates to let them know that, hey, you have a fantastic time, and everyone that I have introduced and have gotten to come to to Canasota for the Hall of Fame have loved it to death.
And it's not just a great chance for you to interact with fans and people from the sport, but there's a good opportunity for you to talk about refereeing from your perspective, and obviously whether people want to get into refereeing or talk about your classic fights or anything like that. And obviously Smitty got you guys, how many of you, about seven or eight of you in the up on the stage on the Saturday, I think, in for a ringside lecture, which some people said was one of the highlights of the weekend. You, Tony Weeks, Jay, and a handful of others.
Yeah, I had mentioned to Ed Brophy a few years back. Actually, it was more his idea of letting us referees get up there at the fairgrounds and speak. And I love doing it because I like to educate the boxing fans. There are a lot of things that the boxing fans are not aware of as far as the rules and the safety of the sport, which all us referees, when we're in our own personal seminars, talk about quite extensively, because if it wasn't for the fighters, we wouldn't have the sport, and we have to protect them. So it's just great to be on stage and to share our knowledge and wisdom to the fans, to educate and get them more in tune as to what we do, what they're looking at, and again, it all works on both ends.
Yeah, and obviously, I think one of the things that we're sort of going around the houses here is it's not an easy job to be a referee, right? And obviously, part of the education process is to point out that it's not just that you're not just sat there in a ringside seat at the big fights. There's pressure. There's a lot of responsibility, a lot of education, and all the rest of it. Like, it's not all glamorous and travel and everything else, is it?
You're right. It's not. At the International Boxing Hall of Fame, we're having a good time and we're interacting with the fans. But when we're in that ring, it's an entirely different ball game. And like you said, there is a lot of pressure on us. And the best thing that us referees can do is take that pressure off of us by making sure that we stay in shape, that we always refreshen our mind on the rules, so that in certain situations, depending upon what happens during the course of the fight, that we're well-versed and know how to respond at that given moment. So we had a nice group of guys up there, and I want to continue to bring other referees up, because there's a ton of us, and I like to get as many as many as different referees up, because we got them from the north to the east, from the south to the west.
Hey, so obviously I mentioned the glamorous side of it. What is the best part of the job? What's the very best thing? Is it getting a top assignment? Is it being in the ring for a top assignment? What's the absolute best, you know, where is it just waiting for that first bell for a major fight? What's the very highlight of the job?
Well, for me, the highlight is, yes, when I get the call to officiate a major fight, a super fight, that it's kind of resonates in my mind as to the fact that I got the call in a lot of situations, depending upon how my work has been in the past, will a lot determine what type of fights I'll be assigned in the future. But when I do get the call, depending upon the fighters, and because I'm a student of the sport as well, if it's a couple of fighters that I've followed their career over the years, and there's no real major concerns, then the main thing that I'll do is continue to work out, continue to revisit certain rules, so that when the fight happens, that I'm prepared. And Yeah, the first time you climb in the ring and you got all the excitement from the fans and all the particulars that are involved. The key thing is to keep our focus, know where we're at and what we're doing, but basically it starts in the dressing room. If I want to get right to the point, when I go in their dressing room and give the final instructions as to what I expect out of them, that's when it gets real. And everything that happens after that just goes with how we train, how we prepare, and what we expect.
And on the flip side, Kenny, how about the worst part of the job? What is the hardest part?
Well, the hardest part is and we go over this in our seminar trainings, is to not get complacent. And if you talk to enough referees, at some point in time in the ring, you can get complacent. And it happened to me several years ago. I was refereeing a fight between Manny Pacquiao and Sugar Shane Mosley. And I just got too comfortable in there. And Manny Pacquiao it was more of a push than a hit. And I ruled it a knockdown. And at the end of the round, I was able to look up at the monitor and see that I made a bad call. And the fans booed me quite a bit, which was deservingly because I missed the call. I shouldn't have missed it, but I got complacent and I did. So it's those moments that when I reflect back on how I officiated a fight, the key thing for me is that, and I'm sure for a lot of referees, is that we have a lot of pride in our work. And though we look to be perfectionists at what we do, we're only human and we're going to make mistakes. But the good thing is that the mistake that I made did not have an effect on the outcome of the fight. And so with that, I can live with the mistake that I made and work toward not allowing it to happen again.
Yeah, I think you make a really good point there, Kenny, talking about complacency, because I think if you see a lot of boxing, right, if you're at fights pretty much every week, whether you're a commentator, whether you're a journalist, whether you're an official, whether you're part of the ring crew, whatever it is, you do become a little bit complacent. Like one fight becomes two fights, becomes five fights, becomes 10 fights, 20 fights. And then obviously it's only really the special stuff that really makes an input or an imprint on you, really stands out. So I think you're right. You sometimes we're watching these four rounders or 10 rounders and it's, you know, 80-72 or 40-36 all the way through, and you know what it's going to be, and you sort of almost watch on autopilot from a ringside seat. And I guess maybe what you're alluding to is something similar, where you've almost not necessarily got a preconceived notion, but where you've seen so much boxing, you just sort of almost expect, oh well, this is the prospect, this is the journeyman, you know, let's just, you know, let's almost go through the motions. I'm not trying to put words in your mouth, but I know from covering a lot of fights ringside, you know, that's kind of after a good 10, 15, 20 years, that's kind of the mindset.
You're right. You know, I've been refereeing, this is my 31st year as a professional. And before I turned professional, I was an amateur referee for quite a few years. So when you look at it, I've been in and out of the ring for, you know, a good 40 years. Yeah. So to be able to be on point every time you get in, which is what we work to do. That moment of complacency kind of wakes you up. Yeah. And say, get back on your A game, because it was an easy call for me to make. I shouldn't have missed it, but I did.
You know what, right, Kenny? Everyone watching, listening to this on the podcast now will be going to YouTube and saying, look, it was that. That's where he messed up. anyway, so obviously you mentioned how long you've been doing it. You grew up in California. Were you a fight fan back in the day, you know, when you were a kid growing up?
Yes. Well, like you said, I grew up in Berkeley, California, which is in the Bay Area, and you get the surrounding cities is Oakland and San Francisco. And growing up for me was watching Muhammad Ali on my mom's old black and white television back in the day. And I just fell in love with the guy at the time. And it wasn't until I moved to Las Vegas that I got involved in the sport, because I moved to Las Vegas in August of 1972. And that next year in February, I actually went to a Muhammad Ali fight here in Las Vegas, and it turned me out. I mean, I just couldn't believe what I was seeing, especially seeing Muhammad Ali in the ring. And from that point on, it just took me up a notch as far as a fight fan, that here in Las Vegas, I can see not only Muhammad Ali, but just see the future fighters, you know, come through the ranks here in Las Vegas. And I just fell in love with it.
Yeah. So, I mean, it's interesting that you mentioned, but was that the Jerry Quarry fight?
No, he fought a guy by the name of Joe Bugner.
Oh, okay. Yeah. Of course I know Joe from this country, right?
Yeah, it's the fight that he fought, and it was, if my memory is correct, it was February the 19th, or it might have been the 14th.
February 14th, 73, it says, yeah.
Yes.
Hey, so, I mean, that's great, but, I mean, we did skip a bit. So you were a track star, right? 4x400 meters.
Yes, and I got started running track through my twin brother. I don't know if you knew. If I had a twin brother, but yes, I do. My twin brother is 9 minutes older than I am, and he started running track first in high school, and he did pretty good. And then when he got to college, it was when I first started as a freshman, and for me, the glory for me was to be able to compete at the level that I did, because my brother tried out for the 72 and the 76 Olympic team. He was good in the open 400. And I was more or less playing a little catch up. But our 4x4 relay team, and we were in Division II, ended up running some world record times in college, and I say that with a lot of pride, because you know, when I was a kid growing up, I was very asthmatic. I had a asthma condition, and my mom used to pray that the Lord would lift that asthma from me, and the Lord did lift that asthma for me. So for me to compete in track like I did, and run the times that we did, and you know, develop the records that we did, said a whole lot for me. And 76, like my brother, I continued to run with the hopes of possibly making the Olympic team, but I was too slow.
What was your 400 meter time? Were you sub 55?
Yeah, I my senior year, I started out running a sub 47, but our relay team, I could run down into the six sub sixes, run a 46. And my brother could run a sub 45. He would usually run the anchor leg, and I would often run the leadoff leg. And to tell you this funny story, people thought that one person was running the first leg and then running the anchor leg because we were identical. And I used to have to tell them, no, it's impossible for me to run lead off 46, 47, and then anchor it in 45. I'd be
superhuman. Yeah, yeah.
Superhuman, exactly, exactly.
That's great stuff. And hey, those are mean times, even in today's day and age, right? Like that's competitive now. Hey, So who's this? I thought that we might hook up in Canastota, so I prepared these questions back then. But who's Johnny Lehman?
Johnny Lehman is a guy back in the day when I was going to the fights after the Muhammad Ali fight that I told you that I watched. I attended every fight in Las Vegas for the next 10 years. Now, at the time, I was just a school teacher. So it wasn't like I made a lot of money. So I would just find ways of getting into the fight. If there was an open back door to the arena, or if there was a crack wide enough for me to squeeze through, I would work my way into the fight. And Johnny Lehman happened to be a guy that worked for the Nevada Commission, and he also worked for the promoters. And I kind of hooked up with him, me and my brother, and for free, because Johnny Lehman was up there in age, and me helping Johnny out was a good thing for him because he was up there in age. And so there were times, depending upon the fight, Johnny could help me get a credential so I didn't have to worry about paying, because back then I couldn't afford to pay for the many fights that were happening back then, because Las Vegas was just on the verge of becoming
the fight capital, really.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes, for the sport of boxing, because shucks, we get 2-3 boxing cards a month. I mean, that's just how the sport just grew in Las Vegas. And so Johnny was very instrumental to me, because if he couldn't get me a credential, then I would look for that crack in the wall, or that open door. But for Johnny, when Johnny retired from working with the commission, because I had worked with him so long, I knew how to be an inspector with the commission, because all those free hours I gave working with Johnny. So when he retired, he told the executive director, hey, this kid knows everything because he's been working with me for years, just helping me out. So going from what I was considered as a glove man, making sure fighters had their spit buckets and towels and various other things, to now I get the appointment to be an inspector for the Nevada Athletic Commission.
You see, people will love your story, Kenny, in the sense that you paid your dues almost to the extreme. But, you know, at times, obviously, you sought advice from people like Jerry Roth and Richard Steele, right?
Yes, yes. So now here I am an inspector with the Nevada Commission. But prior to going in as an inspector, I had decided that I wanted to get more involved. And I didn't know a lot about the sport. And so I said to myself, judging doesn't seem to be difficult. You just sit there for 3 minutes, watch the round, score the round, and then wait for the next round to happen. So I got involved in the amateur Golden Gloves and started judging in the amateurs. And I would still go to the professional shows. Well, going to the professional shows, I hooked up with Jerry Roth. And when I scored fights at the professional shows, I would compare my score with Jerry Roth. Well, at one of the boxing shows, Jerry Roth said this to me one time. He said, Kenny, you appear to be in pretty good shape. Why don't you try refereeing? And my first thoughts when he said that was, oh, no, no, no. I'm not getting in the ring and doing that. And then I thought about it and I thought about it. And I said to myself, well, why not give it a try? So Richard Steele had recently moved to Las Vegas. And I asked Richard, could he show me the art of refereeing? Because in the sport of boxing, there isn't a school like the NFL or the NBA where you can go and work in the like Pop Warner football or Little League baseball or anything like that. We don't have that other than the amateurs. So Richard started training me to be a pro, though I was still in the amateurs. So I went and was doing judging and boxing in the amateur program. And I was focusing more now on the refereeing because I grew to love it. And that's where my loyalty started to go to being a referee.
But even as an inspector, you had some pretty big gigs, right? I think you were an inspector for Spinks Larry Holmes, one of those two fights, and then for Sugar Ray Leonard Marvin Hagler, which, it doesn't get too much better than either of those, really, right?
You're exactly right. There were a lot of super fights, major fights that you mentioned, one with Spinks and Larry Holmes. The first time they fought, I was in Michael Spinks's dressing room and in his corner. And the second time they fought, I was in Larry Holmes's dressing room and in his corner. And fights like Sugar Ray Leonard and Marvin Hagler, I was in Marvin Hagler's dressing room. Shucks, I was in George Foreman's dressing room when he started making his comeback. I was actually with Mike Tyson the night he became the youngest heavyweight champ of the world, when he fought Trevor Burbick. So yeah, I as an inspector, was able to see a lot of great fighters, Tommy Hearns, Roberto Duran, the fight that Richard Steele did between Meldrick Taylor and Julio Cesar Chavez. I was in Meldrick Taylor's corner that night. So yeah, I've literally grown up in the sport from, you know, like I said, being a glove man and just working my way all the way through.
I'm not trying to get you to tell tales here, Kenny, but have you got any interesting anecdotes with your, like, you mentioned some big personalities there, even a young Mike Tyson, but anything that you saw on any of those nights, you had any glove rows or, obviously there was a story, I know it wasn't this fight, but Mike Tyson ahead of the Spinks fight, right, in Atlantic City, where he punched a hole through the dressing room wall. Have you seen or heard anything like that?
Yes, and not only have I heard, I've seen it as well. Mike Tyson fought at Caesar's Palace. I believe it was his first time. And I was the inspector in his dressing room. And I saw him punch a hole in the wall. And the second fight that he fought, when he won the title against Trevor Burrick, the fight was at the Las Vegas Hilton. And Kevin Rooney, which was his trainer at the time, wrapped his hands up. And then he gloved up. And then Kevin Rooney put some pads on, and he was warming Mike Tyson up. So he would hold his pads up, and he'd say to Mike, "Okay, give me a 6-6-7-8." And I'm standing there, and I'm saying, "What is he talking about?" So Mike Tyson started getting into his motion, and he threw a 4-punch combination. Now the dressing rooms back then were single wide trailers, and Mike Tyson hit those mitts with such force, I could feel that single wide trailer swaying like if it was in an earthquake. And I'm sitting there looking at this, saying to myself, he's going to hit somebody with those things. It was just unbelievable, the power he had.
And then, you know, obviously the names Holmes and Hagler, they're great, iconic names, but these guys could also be tricky to deal with. Did you see these guys with any sort of like diva-like demands, or were they difficult, or was it just all business for them on those nights?
Yeah, basically all business. I remember back when Spinks and Larry Holmes fought for the first time. As an inspector has to be there to witness the hand wrapping, as well as a corner man from the opposing camp gets the opportunity to stand there to make sure that everything is done on the up and up. And the hand wrapping went okay. And when it came to the gloving up, there's a thing that is called skinning. And skinning is when a fighter is being laced up, and right above the knuckles, when they're lacing up, they'll take the lace and they'll pressure it on the upper half of the glove and skin it down, which will give it a tighter surface. And skinning is outlawed now, but this was something back in the day that old trainers used to do. And Larry Holmes wanted to do it because that was a custom of the way he would do things. Whereas the Spinks camp was saying, no, you can't do it. Now, Larry Holmes' attitude was that if I don't get to skin it, the fight ain't gonna happen. So now we got a problem. So to solve the problem, what we did was let Spinks redo his gloves. And if he wanted to skin his gloves, then he could skin his gloves just like Larry Holmes skinned his gloves, and everything would be
level playing field, right?
Yeah. Level playing field, yes, sir.
Wow, that's crazy. But interesting, really. It was super interesting. And obviously, I bet Butch Lewis was making scenes, right? I bet Butch Lewis was going crazy, right, for Michael Spinks.
Yeah, Butch is a good guy. Well, was a good guy because, you know, he passed.
Yes.
Passed away a few years ago. But I mean, used to have a lot of fun. He was a very charismatic guy and you know, he was the one that introduced people to wearing a blazer without a shirt on. So
I was just going to say, Kenny, I'm not sure I've seen any of you guys running around with just a bow tie and no blazer. Hey, so yeah, I mean, you obviously alluded to your journey there. So, you know, when I was doing the research for this, you did 12 years in Golden Gloves, 6 with the commission before you became a referee. I mean, so it wasn't necessarily a question of you waiting for the opportunity to come or thinking, oh, it's not going to happen for me. You were just in other roles until you decided to make that step across and become a referee.
Yes, I put such an extended time in the amateurs that when I eventually got appointed with the Nevada Commission, I was up raring and roaring to go because of the amount of time that I had put in. And I read I'm in a book that's called The Third Man in the Ring. And this book was written, oh shucks, it's probably about 10 years now. And what the authors did, they picked out 33 referees and just kind of wrote their story. Yep. And I got a copy of the book and read it and was just amazed at how some of the other referees got started in comparison to how I got started. I had put in a lot of work prior to getting appointed in comparison to some of the other referees' career as to how short-lived their amateur situation was in reference to turning from amateur to pro. And there were even some referees that never even did amateurs. They went straight into pro. But
even then, though, Kenny, you weren't fast-tracked, right? I think 1991 to 1994 were your first 3 years in the pros, and then your first world title fight came after 3 years on the job. So it's not like you walked in, you know, kicked the door in and was like, yeah, this is the new guy. You know, even then you had another apprenticeship to serve.
Yeah. Well, back then, you know, at the time, as far as referees here, we had Richard Steele, we had Carlos Padilla, we had Davey Pearl. They were the top referees, as well as Mills Lane. So when I got on, I was doing some of the smaller title fights, which was good. But as referees, we always look for the big super fight, because sure, the big super fight is the ones that we strive for, just like an NBA official wanting to be in the NBA finals, or an umpire wanting to be in the World Series. I mean, that's what you strive for. And my big super fight. Now, I was just doing a little homework the other day, and Ricardo Lopez was my first world title fight. Ricardo Lopez. But my first big super fight. Now, I did a Roy Jones Jr. Antonio Tarver fight. But my first super fight was when Oscar De La Hoya fought Bernard Hopkins. And that was a lot of pressure.
Yeah. So obviously, you know, you've blown away a couple of my questions there, because in my research, I do have you doing Jones Tarver 1, and I have you doing obviously Ricardo Lopez for your for that. Let me get to Hopkins Oscar in a sec. When did you first say what I say you must obey? Do you remember when you came up with that?
Yes, my middle son. I have three sons.
And you said to the kids.
and I was a very strong disciplinarian as a teacher, and I raised my sons the same way. And my middle son, Kenny Jr., says to me, "Dad, why don't you have a catchphrase?" And I said, "Well, I don't have one, and I don't really care to have one." And he says, "No, Dad, you got to have a catchphrase." Because at the time, Mills Lane had "Let's Get It On," and that it become very popular. So I didn't think about it. So my son comes up to me and he says, "Dad, what about what?" And I had to clean up what he said. "What I say, I say it, you obey it." And I said, "Well, that's coming a little too strong." So I just modified it a little bit and came up with "What I say, you must obey." And I've stuck with it ever since.
I like it. Okay, and then let's go back to Hopkins Oscar, because obviously Oscar was coming in off that disputed win over Felix Sturm. He'd moved up to middleweight. Hopkins had obviously beaten Trinidad, who had beaten Oscar. So there's a whole lot of form guide there for you to study, I guess, ahead of the fight. Is that right? You go back and maybe watch some of these old fights and see how these guys box and, you know, yes, study the form at weight and all that kind of stuff.
But not only go back and watch some of their formal fights, I'm watching their fights as they progress in the sports. I'm watching them, so I'm taking mental notes. And the mental notes that I'm speaking of is basically us referees. We want a clean fight. That's why we're in there, is to make sure that it's clean. So, you know, I've been watching Oscar De La Hoya since he was in the Olympics. I think he was in the Seoul, 88 Seoul Olympics.
No, it was the Barcelona 92.
Oh, Barcelona, right. Yeah. Barcelona, right. And so I'm watching their careers as they're working their way up the ladder to become world champions. And I saw nothing as far as anything controversial in Oscar. Oscar fights a clean fight. Up till then, I saw nothing really a problem with Bernard. So I had no problems going into fight with the mindset that I was going to have to admonish anyone for doing anything dirty or anything out of the norm of what's expected of a fighter in the ring. Now, I did have to, during the course of the fight, because separate them and give them a caution, because we have to stay a step ahead of what they're doing. And I, it's easier if I extend my admonishment ahead of time, as opposed to wait it for it to happen. And then you're in a position on, are you going to have to deduct points or not? So I at one point in the fight, separated them and looked at both of them and gave them a stern warning on the hitting and holding and the minor stuff. And but the key thing for me in that particular fight was when Oscar De La Hoya went down on the body shot. I happened to be circling around Bernard Hopkins. I could see him throw the punch, but I didn't see where it landed. Now, we've been taught to respond to what we see. If you don't see it, you don't call it. Well, I didn't see the shot land, and now Oscar's on the ground. So I go over and I pick up the count from the timekeeper, and I'm counting, and I'm thinking to myself while I'm counting, because Oscar's kind of doubled up, and I'm thinking to myself, was that punch low or was it a good punch? And so I'm counting. I've already started counting. Well, I got to keep counting now. So I count Oscar out. The people jumping in this, the media and the corners are in the ring, and they're running all around doing what they do. And I step back and I look up at the monitor and I'm saying to myself, dear Lord, I sure hope that was a clean punch. And when they showed it, it was clean. And it was a relief for me, because if that punch had been low and I counted him out, that wouldn't have looked good at all.
Wow, Kenny, I've got to say, your stories and your honesty is great. Like, the stuff that you see and the way that you observe it is great. And the way that you talk about it, I'm getting a real kick out of it. And that Oscar thing was great. You kind of preempted my question, because you remember at the time there were people like saying, you know, not did he take a dive, but people thinking, was that shot all that and all the rest of it. So obviously one of my questions was, you know, with how much intent did that shot land? But you didn't see it. that's interesting. You did one of the wars, right? You did one of Barrera Morales, the third one, right? I think.
Yes. And that fight came right after the Oscar De La Hoya Bernard Hopkins fight. And what a war that fight was. It was a war. And I had to be more on my toes in that fight than I did with Oscar and Bernard Hopkins. Because Oscar Bernard Hopkins, I believe the fight ended in the eighth round. Whereas with Barrera and Morales, that fight went the distance. And if I'm recalling right, I got real close to possibly taking a point. I didn't take a point. But I was getting close because these guys were going at it, and it was either punches thrown after my command, or there was something going on that drew me close. But in hindsight, before taking points, what I do is I give what I call soft warnings. They're soft. That means that you keep fighting. And I'm just going to motion or say what you need to stop doing. And if it continues, when I stop and give the hard warning, now I'm going to start deducting points. Well, I didn't deduct a point. And at the end of the fight, one of the commissioners came up to me. He was pleased with my work, and what made him more pleasing to my work was the fact that I did not take a point. The fight came to its natural conclusion. The scoring is what determined who won the fight.
hey, when you have a fight like that, Kenny, and you know that these guys, you know, they've gone at it twice before, and you kind of know what you're going to expect in that third fight where it's going to be a war and it's going to be entertaining. Do you think, like, not necessarily I'm going to get my popcorn ready for this, but wow, this is, here we go again. This is like the touch paper. These guys are going to go at it.
Yeah. You know, when we look at styles of a fighter, that for the most part is going to dictate, if I was to preempt what's going to happen or what to look for, the styles is the key. And with Morales and Barrera, they're both come forward style fighters. And so, yeah, in my preparation, I knew that they're one guy is not going to have to look and try to find the other guy. They're going to both be standing right in front of each other. So I prepare myself that way, mentally and physically.
And then another of the plum ones that you did was obviously, it was probably the biggest fight in the at the time, maybe even in history at the time. It was Oscar against Mayweather.
Yes.
And that was, I mean, that was the one really where, I mean, I don't like this terminology, but where Mayweather permanently flipped from B-side to A-side and just became obviously brand Mayweather. But what was that like to officiate? Because it wasn't the most thrilling fight in the world. Oscar seemed to run up a bit of a lead and then faded away a bit, and Floyd was a bit more accurate in the second half.
Yeah, they said that the best weapon that Oscar had was the jab. And for whatever reasons, and I remember the media asking Oscar, why did he abandon the jab? The jab was working, so why not keep using it? And I believe Oscar's response was, it was other things going on, and he felt that there was no need to use it at the time, whereas it was working. So, but yes, that was a high level fight. Again, you're dealing with styles. Floyd Mayweather has more of a like a peekaboo style. But when Floyd was in his early years, fighting at a lighter weight, he fought and made the adjustments that he needed to at those lighter weights. But then sure, as he moved up in weight and he's fighting a bigger and heavier guy, you have to make adjustments. And I know there are a lot of fight fans didn't like the adjustments that he made, but he's the one that's in there, so he has to make the adjustments that suits him best.
Well, yeah, and I also think Floyd gets a little bit of a rough deal here sometimes with people thinking that he was just punch and move and all the rest of it. And obviously there were fights, you know, against Canelo and Robert Guerrero where people hardly laid a glove on him. But then he had those arguments with Cotto and Maidana, like big bloody fights, you know, hard fights, you know, and they were up in weight too. And I'm right in thinking you did Floyd's debut, right? Did you do the Robert Apodaca fight up in North Vegas somewhere?
Yes. Yeah, I did his first fight, which was that particular hotel. It was called the Texas Station. I don't even know if the hotel is still there now here in Vegas. They changed the names quite a bit and implode and different things. But yeah, I did his first debut. It was a first round knockout, and I just been blessed as his career got to the heights and the level that it got to still be around in the sport and do quite a bit of his fights in my later years, not his later years, my later years.
It would be easy to turn around and say, oh, you know, I always knew Floyd was going to be special. Obviously, he was an Olympian from 96, and obviously he made his debut. So it would be easy to say, oh, yeah, I always knew he was special. But is there anyone that you saw coming up where you, like, thought this guy is going to be one to watch? And either he did or didn't turn out to be spectacular.
There's been a few. Sugar Shane Mosley, I had the pleasure of seeing quite a few of his fights when he, well, back then he was just doing, you know, six and eights and was working his way up. But I could look and tell by his quickness, his speed, and his boxing ability that he was going to become a world champ. You could just see it. There's been a few. Miguel Cotto, seeing his early years, you could see and you could know that at some point in time he's going to become a world champ.
I'm glad you mentioned Cotto because he was next on my list. So we obviously mentioned the glove things with Spinks and Larry. You also did you were the referee for Miguel Cotto's fight with Antonio Margarito, which was one of the best fights of the year in what, maybe 2007, 2008, something like that.
Yeah.
And, you know, I mean, well, tell me about that fight for a start, because that was a bloody war. And obviously Cotto eventually wilted, I think, in the last half of the fight. So tell me about what it was like being in that ring that night, because Cotto's face was a bloody mask and it was a hard, hard fight, wasn't it?
It was an extremely hard fight. I thought the first half of the fight, Cotto was fighting a master fight. His game plan, which was not difficult, was to get off three or four combinations and then move. And for the first three or four rounds, for me, and they were fighting clean. That Cotto was doing a masterful job. Three or four combinations, duck and weave, and then move to another portion of the ring. When Antonio Margarito got over there, before he get set, Cotto would hit him with three or four combinations, and then he'd move again. And that was basically the pattern of the fight. And I believe it got around the fifth round, might have been the sixth. I thought that Cotto stood in the trenches just a little too long and got hit by some Margarito shots. And those shots that Margarito hit Cotto with, I felt at the time, started to show a little wear and tear on Cotto. And now when Cotto would move, Antonio Margarito was almost getting to the spot before he got there, because he knew that he could see what I saw. And Cotto still was a smart fighter, because he took a knee, which I had to give him an eight count. And at the time I thought that he was using it to buy some time, because the fight was getting up into the later rounds, and I thought that he had won the earlier rounds. But then when he took that second knee, before I could even start a counter anything, his corner threw the towel in.
So a fight or two later, it was found that Margarito was, his gloves weren't legitimate, shall we say, going into the fight with Shane Mosley. And I think it was in LA, right? In the maybe of the January, Nazim Richardson busted them in the back.
Yes.
Do you know for a fact that everything was fair and above board in Vegas, or would you like to get that one back and double check everything?
Well, it was actually the very next fight that Sugar Shane Mosley fought Antonio Margarito. And yes, they did find that substance that in the wraps that the Antonio Margarito's trainer was using. But It's going to always be hard to tell or know what was used when Margarita fought Cotto, because the hand wraps are something that are not saved. When the fight is over with, they take the gloves off, take the wraps off, and they just usually throw them away. Mm. And not unless they were able to have confiscated the wraps from Margarita after the Cotto fight, which they didn't, because they didn't suspect anything. I didn't suspect anything. The only person that would know would be Cotto, because he's the guy that's getting hit. But from my viewpoint, and, you know, I've seen quite a few fights over the years, it was just a normal Cotto, like I mentioned earlier, taking too many shots in the trenches, and Margarita just wearing him down.
Yeah, I mean, I think Cotto, what was it on the HBO 24/7, him and Margarita in that rematch, Cotto seems adamant that there was foul play. But obviously, we'll never know. We, like, you know, as much as we might want to find out, I don't know that there's any way unless people involved tell us anything that we don't already know. But let me ask you this, Kenny. Obviously, that was a bruising fight, right? It was a violent fight. When you're watching that and you're hearing the lever on face and therefore brain, and obviously we know stuff about CTE, and, you know, I've written this book recently. I don't know if you've heard about it, but Damage, where it's about long-term brain injuries in boxing and that kind of stuff. You must, it's a grisly thing, isn't it, to have to reconcile with, that these guys are taking loans out against their future well-being, right?
Yes. Yeah, it's a tough business. It's tough. And that's why, you know, us referees are put in a position where, in our training, and I know fight fans don't like it, in our training, we are taught to stop it too soon than to stop it too late. Now, to a fight fan that's getting the thrill of their life from two guys slugging it out and wanting to see more, and then we step in and stop it, we're doing it because of the safety of the fighter. I mean, that fighter has a family, just like we all do. And if that fighter wants to continue in the sport, there has to be somebody that's looking out for him. And that only one person is us. Now, the corners, you know, they have the option to throw in the towel. We don't, in Nevada, particularly use that method anymore. We would like that corner man to come up on the ring apron, which, with the inspector, which will stop the fight. Wow. But again, the bottom line is enough is enough. And if the corner man don't do it, then us referees just have to take charge and do the right thing. If the fighter makes it through the round, and then we have the option of calling the ring doctor up to look at him. But it's all about safety. It's safety is the key to everything when it comes to two fighters in the ring.
And obviously we talked a bit about research and that kind of stuff in terms of you researching fighters beforehand. And obviously that's vital now with what we know about CTE and people getting damage over time, in the sense that fighters who have a high mileage aren't the same as they were 10 years ago, 15 years ago, you know, so you need to be mindful. While obviously, you know, every fight, I suppose, is a blank canvas, but you also need to be well aware of what these guys are and what they've been through, right?
Yes. Yeah. You know, people, fans don't know that any fighter, and a lot of the other states are the same way. When you get licensed, and that state will give you It's like a passport. Yeah. It looks like a passport. And it's got the fighter's information in it as to who they are as far as identity. And then whenever that fighter fights in the state of Nevada, the fight doctor will put in if they won or lost, how many rounds, and how they lost. If it was a TKO, if it was a KO. Now, that information is put in there for the safety of that fighter, so that if that fighter got knocked out, the fight doctor can indicate when he should go back in the ring and spar and practice. It could be, they call it a 30-60 or a 60-90, as far as when you should start sparring again or training and when you should accept another fight.
Right.
Because you don't want a guy to get knocked out in May and then in the month of June, he's climbing back in the ring again to fight.
Yeah.
That's where these serious injuries take place, because the brain has to heal just like any other part of the body. If it's injured, has to heal. And the way the brain heals is through rest. So if a fighter is fighting every other month or whatever the case may be, and he continues to not do too well and take a lot of headshots, yeah, it's going to be a serious issue a few years down the road, or it could be deadly at the time.
Yeah, so one of the things that really comes into this is the thing that they call second impact syndrome, right? Which is why when a football player suffers a head injury, they get him off the field now, because if he sustains another one, it could be curtains or it could be a long road ahead for him. So it's get him out of harm's way. I suppose, obviously, the difference with boxing is you can look after people, say they get damaged in one fight, and then keep them out of the ring until the next fight. But the problem is if they get damaged earlier in a fight, and the fight's still on, you know, and then what right. can you do? But obviously that's stuff that you is, you know, there's no tracking for that during a fight anyway. Hey, but you have had, Kenny, you must have had some scary moments, because I've covered some fights ringside where, geez, man, like you did Hatton Pacquiao, right?
Yes.
And then, I mean, I may as well carry on with this front. You know, I also did Pacquiao Marquez 4. And, yes. You know, these are situations where, you know, literally these guys go down. Obviously, I'm not stood where you're stood, but I think the worst, you know, they literally just nothing. You know, they yeah. just, they're out cold. And yeah. how terrifying is that for you when the guys go down in that fashion?
It's terrifying. The first time it happened for me was a small card at the Orleans. And the fighter got hit with one punch and he went down. And when I could tell by the way he went down that it was serious, because it was like cutting a light switch off in his brain.
Yep.
And when I looked over him before, and I didn't even pick up the count, I could see his pupils going into the back of his head. The doctors got in, he was suffering from second concussion syndrome. They took him to the hospital, cerebral hematoma. They did surgery, stopped the bleeding, sewed him back up. The bleeding started again and he died. And it was tough for me. Back then, I didn't know if I wanted to referee anymore. Mm. It was the heartbreaking, it was. And if it wasn't for the executive director telling me that the next fight card, you're going to be in it, so, you know, dry up your tears and get ready, because you're on the next fight card. So it wasn't like I had time to console myself, let alone, you know, console the family of the fighters. But I got through it, and yeah, it's tough. And that isn't the only time I experienced. I've experienced a total of 3 ring deaths in my 31 year career. You just never know. I mean, I've stopped a fight from a kid. This was the second time, and the fans booed me so bad for stopping it that when I climbed out of the ring and it was down ringside, I didn't know where to go. It was like it was an angry mob out there waiting for me because I stopped the fight. And now this fight took place Saturday. Monday morning, the fighter who was a world champion, they found him dead.
Who was that, Kenny?
I believe his name was Alcaraz.
Okay.
I could look it up for you if.
Yeah, no, it's fine.
Yeah. And he was a champ. It was a world title fight. And yeah. The kid was from Panama. And so, yeah, it was like the nerve of you stopping this fight. But people don't have trained eyes like us referees do. We're trained to see and look for things. Yeah. Whereas for the fans, it's more entertainment for them.
Well, I mean, it kind of goes back to what you said a minute ago about stopping a fight a moment too early rather than too late. You know, no one wants to be in a position where they have to live with that ultimate regret. And I suppose you have that, you know, being friends with Richard Steele, you will always have that archetypal demonstration, especially because you were there that night, of Meldrick Taylor and Chavez, obviously, where not only stopping it with a second too early, but 2 seconds before the clock ran out, but is it worth a roll of the dice and thinking, if Chavez had gone out and landed one more blow, what happens then?
Right, exactly. I've had to tell people after that call and after we took Meldrick Taylor back to his dressing room, as soon as he walked into his dressing room, he threw up blood. And the blood that he threw up was because he had lacerations on the inside of his lip. And during the course of the fight, he was swallowing it.
Right.
He had 2 orbital fractures over both eyes. And they said he was totally dehydrated. He was never the same after that fight.
Yeah.
That fight took his career from him. It did.
And that's another thing, like the hydration things. I mean, how much are you clued in as a referee about how these guys might have struggled to make the weight? I mean, I've covered obviously a lot of fights, and you hear the horror stories of people in saunas and sweatsuits and all the rest of it. Do the commissioners tell you, like, oh, you know, we've heard this guy's had to lose X amount of pounds? And I suppose on the flip side, Kenny, does someone say, wow, this guy has put on 20 pounds since yesterday? Like, maybe be vigilant about that.
Well, maybe not that much in a short time, but what the boxing organizations are starting to do now is do a pre-weigh-in, maybe a month and a half out.
Yeah.
And then in the next 3 weeks or 4 weeks, they'll come back and they'll weigh them again to see the progression of how they're losing the weight.
Sure.
And that helps a lot, because now at least you got someone monitoring them and keeping an eye on what they're doing as far as the amount of weight that they have to lose. So it makes a lot of fighters be a little more responsive to between fights, letting their body go up.
Sure.
20, 30 pounds, and now they have to lose it all prior to a fight that they have signed to do.
The gentleman we were thinking of was Pedro Alcazar, right?
Yes.
From back in the day, I think 2002, and against Fernando Montiel, who was also a great fighter. And in terms of scary moments as well, and I've tried to stop throwing these at you, Kenny, but another one had to be when Amir Khan was bombed out by Canelo.
Yes. Yeah, that was another tough one because Amir Khan was doing well in that fight. He was quicker, faster than Canelo, but Amir Khan had moved up in weight. And there's always a concern when guys are moving up and down in weight because of what they're doing to their body. And when he got hit with that one shot that took him out, concern. Just like when you mentioned earlier with Marquez and Pacquiao.
Yeah.
When Pacquiao went down. That was a scary moment when Pacquiao, like you mentioned, knocked out Ricky Hatton. That was a scary moment because it's like the clock is ticking. There's nothing you can do. I mean, the doctors, and we got great doctors in here in Nevada, and they do what they do to make sure that these guys are okay, but if the brain is bleeding, there is nothing you can do until you get them to the hospital and do surgery to stop it. And when it's stopped, you just hope that it doesn't start back again.
Now, don't take this the wrong way. I don't mean this necessarily with humor, but when you look at those three knockouts, so Canelo and Khan, Marquez, Pacquiao, and Hatton, Pacquiao, is literally the first thing that goes through your mind, oh shit.
Not initially. I mean, there's a concern there.
Yeah.
Because I don't know if they're going to get up or not. I have to wait to give them that opportunity.
We're all for the clock. Yeah, of course. Yes. The 10 count. Yeah, sure.
For an example, when Deontay Wilder fought Tyson Fury, the first fight.
Yeah, and the Jack Reese count. That, yep.
Yes, and Jack Reese did a fantastic job. Jack Reese should have got more credit for the way he handled it. Because when Tyson Fury went down, the way he went down, he could have easily just stopped it. But because of the magnitude of the fight, because of what had happened in the 11 rounds prior to the 12th, Jack gave Fury the opportunity to see if he could get up. And he did. And who would have guessed that he would have gotten up? And then people say, yeah, but he was out. Yeah, but you got to understand the position that a referee is in. Now, if Fury had gotten up and when Jack asked him to step to the right and step to the left, that's what we trained. That's how we prepare ourselves for fights, for that moment. And so Jack did everything he was supposed to do in that moment. And the fight continued. The fight ended up a draw. And from that move that Jack made, they fought two more times after that.
Yeah, sure. Sure. Hey, and then obviously when we talk about mega fights, you've did the biggest fight of all time, right? Floyd against Manny Pacquiao, which the highest grossing fight of all time. Obviously, the connoisseurs might have thought, hey, that's not a bad fight, but it wasn't what people had hoped for. Are you thinking, is there anything that you could have done to have made that a more attractive spectacle, or is it just a case of it was what it was by the time they fought?
The fight, when I knew that I was doing the fight, got the assignment to do it, I had no worries about either one of the fighters, because I had refereed Manny just as much as I had refereed Mayweather. I mean, I had refereed them both a few times. They both fight clean. I wasn't worried about anything when it came to that. Now, you're right. People were expecting a blood and guts, a rock 'em, sock 'em turnout. And that isn't what I was expecting because of knowing the fighters. I thought it was a very scientific fight. Floyd brought that. I know Manny wanted to engage more, but I so many people hit me up about the fight that it was this and it was that, and they wanted more. And if you know the fight game, if the Warriors, the Golden State Warriors NBA basketball team, run and gun, and they're successful at doing it, then that's what they're going to do. You can't expect that they're going to change their style because of what an individual likes. They're going to do what works for them. And when you got an individual sport like boxing, fighter is going to do what works for him.
Hey, let me armchair quarterback this with you, Kenny, because you were in the ring with Manny Pacquiao the night he beat Miguel Cotto, which for many was his best performance at welterweight. Would that Manny Pacquiao of 2009 put a bigger dent in the Floyd Mayweather when they fought in 2015?
I don't think so.
Okay.
I don't. I think...
it's a typical styles make fights thing, right? It's a styles make fights thing. Yeah.
And I know that Floyd has the ability to slip punches. He does that better than anybody in the game. He just does. Because he does, he's hard to hit. And guys have thought that, I'll hit him. And then they get in there and they can't hit him. And then what's plan B? There has to be a plan B, because if plan A fails, then you're sunk. And the number of times that I've been in the ring with him and seen guys try to catch him. Now, I'll tell you this. Sugar Shane Mosley caught him when they fought. But then the question is, how do you follow up on that? And Sugar Shane was unsuccessful in following up, but Sugar Shane hit him and he hurt him.
Yep.
So, sure. Yeah.
Hey, and then in terms of Plum fights, and we've talked about quite a few of them here, where, I mean, I think I was just as interested in your Inspector stuff in the 80s, which was sensational as well as these massive marquee fights in the modern era. But you had Canelo and Golovkin as well, right? And that you talk about two guys at the height of their powers, really. Like, they were two primetime middleweights back then, weren't they?
Yes, they were. That's a trilogy that will go down with a number of great trilogies that have been fought over the years. I was just talking with a friend of mine, Mickey Ward.
Oh, Ward Gatti, yeah.
And Gatti, that trilogy, fantastic trilogy. The trilogy with Ali and Joe Frazier, fantastic trilogy. And I was fortunate to do the Triple G Canelo first fight. And it was a fantastic fight. It was. Now, people ask me, well, who do you think won? Well, when I get in there, my mind and sole focus is on the fighters. I don't have a score pad in my brain and scoring each round. But who do you thought? Well, that fight was so close. The only thing that could have swayed it for me would have been when Canelo was on the ropes. And there was a time or two when he went to the ropes and was fighting off the ropes. Now, the question is, how effective was he on the ropes, or how effective was he not? And other than that, It was a close fight. Well, all their fights have been close.
Let me ask you this. Obviously, we're talking about this trilogy. We're taking it for granted that the third fight is going to be Dynamite again. Kenny, I wanted to ask you this, right? Obviously, we talked about the fights and all the rest of it. In 2003, though, you were diagnosed with prostate cancer, which is a year on from the Alcazar fight. That had to be beyond a rough time, you know, a fatality in the ring, and then you're diagnosed with a form of cancer. That was terrifying.
Yes, it was. And it was a very difficult time for me because with all the struggles, with all the politics and working my way up through the ranks to become the referee that I dreamed to be, and then to have this pop up was tough. I was in a situation where I didn't know what was going to happen next, but I'm blessed with a wife that's a wellness coach and health educator, and we were able to get through the hard times.
How bad was the diagnosis and all the rest of it, and how long was the treatment?
Well, I actually just went and took the I didn't go through any treatment. I just didn't want chemo or radiation, and I just went with having my prostate removed.
Okay.
Yeah, and luckily the cancer did not get out. It was contained, and that was a blessing.
Yeah, of course. And then on the plus side, you have boxing's taking you to around the world. Obviously, you've done gigs in China and all over, but it's also taking you to Hollywood, and you've done stuff. You did Creed and Ray Donovan and different things like that. Have you enjoyed doing that stuff?
Yes, I have. And I guess it couldn't have come at a better time, because when Sylvester Stallone did the first Rocky, well, I was just a boxing fan. I think that fight came out in the early 70s.
Yeah, sure. Early mid 70s, yeah, mid to late, yeah.
Yeah. But when I became a referee and they went to Rocky 1, 2, and they just kept going with the Rocky series, I got to the point to where I just always kind of wanted to be in one just for the experience. But it never happened. So I just kind of left that thought alone. And 3 years ago or so, Creed 2 comes up and I get the call, which was heartwarming for me. And I did. And then we just shot Creed 3. At least my scenes, just back in April. So it's an experience. But before that, there's a show here on Showtime called Ray Donovan. And there was a fight scene in it, and I got to do that part. So I've been blessed. I've been lucky.
And then just one last one, Kenny, in closing. Obviously, you know, people want government reform and a federal commission to look after the sport, right? To make sure that everyone's singing off the same hymn sheet and that everyone has the same medical issues, that everyone shares the same information, not just in the US, but globally, right? It would be super helpful for everyone. Is there any scope for any kind of referees union or referees federation to link up referees from around the world so that you can just provide referees for around the world, or certainly in hotspots, whether it's the UK, New York, Vegas, all the big destinations? Is that something that could or should happen, and all the education is centralized and that kind of stuff?
Well, years ago, we tried to start a union amongst referees, and it just didn't work. It didn't work a lot to do with the individual referee as far as where their status was at the time, and and how far they were pushing to get to the status that they wanted to be at, as opposed to officials. And I'm talking about judges as well, because this was a discussion that came up for judges and referees. And it was the same thing for the referees and judges that were already, let's say, at an A status and wanting to stay at an A status and not have anything disturb or change that. So I don't know about other states, but I know we tried it and we just could not get everybody on the same page. So as of now, we're just looked at as independent contractors. And basically the way it works is that if you get the call or the assignment to work a show, you work it. If you don't get the call to for an assignment, then you don't work it. So it's kind of you do or you don't. And there isn't really a whole lot else that you can do about it.
Sure. I suppose when we started at the top of the conversation, you were talking about how important it is to know the rules and the regulations and all that kind of stuff. Like, even that would be helpful, though, if we had some kind of federal oversight so that all of this stuff was uniformed, right? Because only there's certain places where a doctor can stop the fight still and certain places where they can't. Like you said about the towel as well, the towel doesn't have to be accepted in some regions and it does in others. Like, it would be helpful for the sport to start bringing all this stuff together, right?
Well, we do have an organization called the American Boxing Commissions, and they call it the ABC. And basically, that's what they try to do. And it has worked pretty well, believe it or not, is in reference to the rules, work with the four major governing bodies, the WBO, the WBA, the WBC, and the IBF, and try to concise the rules so that we all can work with, so that we don't have one state doing it this way, another state doing it that way, and make it more workable for everyone. And a lot of times when we get recertified, you can get recertified through the ABC. And yeah. Again, the ABC is the American Boxing Commissions.
Okay. And Kenny, I'm just going to cheat. I'm going to ask one more, if I may. The VAR thing, video assisted replay, you mentioned that Oscar low blow stroke body shot. What was it? Would you encourage this use of video replay for people, I guess, and not least based on that, or do you think it should be what the referee sees, or would you like a monitor to be able to go to and say, you know, what's happened?
Well, Nevada was the first to institute instant replay. We developed a panel of referees as well as ex-referees. And we went from A to Z and back to A on instant replay, when to use it. We also got instituted a replay official. So at all our shows in Nevada, we have a replay official that will sit at ringside with a monitor, maybe two. And whenever an incident happened, like the fighter's hits touch, or don't touch, and there's a cut over a fighter's eye. Now, if I rule it a punch, but yet it was an accidental headbutt, we want that call to be right. So the replay official can look at it, and if I call it an accidental headbutt, and it was an accidental headbutt, then he just leaves it alone. But if I call it an accidental headbutt and it was a punch, then the outcome can be completely different. So in a situation like that, the instant replay official puts a amber light up on the ring apron to notify me that there's something that needs to be addressed.
Right.
When there's a lull in the action, I'll call timeout. I will go over to the replay official, look at the situation, And if I have to correct it, it will be corrected then and there so that we get the right call. And that's what the replay is all about for us now. Same thing with low blows, any call that can change the outcome of the fight. We're given that opportunity, and it could be at the end of the round. I can still go over to check with the replay official. They can instruct me as to, and I can see what the call is. And if I need more time, when the bell rings, I can put the fighters in the neutral corner and continue with the replay official till we get the right call.
Great stuff, Kenny. This has been absolutely wonderful. I'm really grateful for your time. Thank you so much. And shame we couldn't do it in person in Canastota, but hey, I know it's crazy out there anyway. You're always on the go and a lot of demands and that kind of stuff. But keep on keeping on. And thank you very much, Kenny. I'm grateful.
Okay. Thank you for having me.
All right. Take care. Bye-bye.
All right. Bye-bye.
I love that chat with Kenny. The stuff in the 80s was a great window into the life of a commissioner, and he was brilliant talking about the mind of the referee and what's gone through his head at huge moments in massive fights in this sport's history. Kenny was top draw, and as I said at the top, I'm pleased we didn't grab a quick 45 minutes in New York and we held off to here. Not only grateful to Kenny, but grateful to my sponsors, as always. Blaz at Hanson Lee Resourcing. They were voted the UK's best specialist insurance sector recruitment firm at the Corporate Excellence Awards. Not only do Hanson Lee find you the best people, they'll help you retain them. And you can find out more at hansonlee.com. We're also brought to you by Delco Safety Compliance, and they are a leading provider of professional fire risk assessments and safety services nationwide. They provide expert impartial advice on all aspects of fire, health and safety compliance. And you can find out more at delcosafety.co.uk. And we'll be back next week.